I'm Evan Applegates, I'm a cartographer, and on Very Expensive Maps, I talk to better cartographers. This week you'll hear from writer and mapmaker John Taranak. John has been creating maps of New York City for 50 years. He chaired the MTA committee that produced the official 1979 subway map, and he's walked every street in Manhattan to create his own hyper-detailed maps of the island's subways, buses, streets, and sights.
My name is John Taranak, and officially I'm at West End Avenue, New York, New York. I describe myself as writing on New York social and architectural history and designing maps.
How did you first come to make maps?
I stumbled. I was, as the euphemism goes, between jobs, and I was waiting on tables in the Promenade Cafe in Rockefeller Center. I had worked at J. Walter Thompson as a copywriter for 7 years, and I knew, they were in the Gray Bar building at 420 Lexington, and I knew the passageways of Grand Central pretty well. And my father had managed the Biltmore Hotel on 43rd and Madison, which linked directly with Grand Central. So, you know, as a six-year-old, I was walking those passageways. And here I was at Rockefeller Center with all the network of undercover passageways there. And I realized that I should write a story about how pedestrians could take undercover passageways through and under buildings in Midtown to stay dry in the wet and warm in the cold. And I started writing it, and it was an instant cure for insomnia. Never took a course in graphic design or anything of that nature. I made roughs. I showed the roughs to the editors of New York Magazine. They said they liked them. They handed my roughs over to a graphic designer who metamorphosed them into the finished product. And the first of the undercover maps, that one of Midtown, was published in January or February 1972. I was then asked if I would do a sequel of Lower Manhattan, which was published about a year later. And then I went back into advertising, and I had already started giving tours of the city. I was giving tours for the Municipal Art Society, and they asked me if I would like to write the guidebooks for the two culture bus loops that the Metropolitan Transportation Authority was operating. The Culture Bus Loop 1 went from Midtown up to the Cloisters, and Culture Bus Loop 2 did Lower Manhattan and from Brooklyn Heights to Prospect Park.
The MTA used to run a culture bus?
It operated on the weekends and holidays, and you would buy a ticket for the day. You could get off at the first stop that interested you, go see what you wanted to look at, and get back on the next bus that came along, and they were scheduled to operate every 20 minutes. So I did the guidebooks, and the MTA liked them, and the then executive director of the MTA was a great Londonophile, and he believed that whatever the London Transport did, the MTA should do, which explains why we had double-decker buses for a while. And London had published a travel guide to London. So he thought, you know, why don't we have this guy Taranak write a travel guide for us? And in the spring of 76, in time for the bicentennial, it was published. And it included a true geographic depiction of the operation of the subway. When I started overseeing the work, which was being executed by a graphic designer who was who had contracted with the MTA, Mike Hertz, we talked about the impossibility of depicting a true geographic map with the then existing color coding system, which ascribed an individual color to each of the subsets of subway lines. So on the West Side IRT, the 1, 2, and 3, there were three colors. Midtown had something like 18 colors going north and south. So a true geographic depiction was out of the question. So I asked the Transit Authority. They regarded my request as the tail wagging the dog, because if I got to change the color coding system so that there was a single color ascribed to each of the trunk lines, they would have to change every sign in the system. Not just platform edge signs, but roll signs on the subways, directional signs, you name it. It would have cost a gazillion dollars. They kept saying, no, you may not do that. So I said, can I depict the operations with two colors? Or even three, you know, the IRT, the BMT, the IND. No. Each individual line had to have its own color. The problem was there were some colors that were used two, three times because there are only so many colors that the human eye can easily distinguish. So we made the route in one color, red, and running alongside the red line were the color-coded discs in the individual colors of the routes that were operating. And that was the first go at it. And Seeing New York was published in the spring of 76, by which time the Transit Authority had instituted a subway map committee, and I was asked to chair it. And I did, from 76 until it was published in 79. And in 1978, we tested the map at an art gallery called Citiana, and we mounted a show that depicted the history of subway maps. And then there was the great subway map debate held in the Great Hall of Super Union between me and Massimo Vignelli.
What did you and Vignelli differ on?
Everything. One of my quotes is depicting the schematic map of Vignelli. And I said, I'm a native New Yorker, and I know what New York looks like, and it doesn't look like this. And then I talked about what I described as the cartographic verities. You ask a group of fifth graders what color a park is on a map, and to a kid, you'll hear green. And what color is water, class? Blue. Well, Vignelli had gray park and beige water. And I came to regard that as a cynical reflection of the reality of the color of water around Manhattan Island, because it was dirty. He was talking in abstractions all the while. I was trying to be concrete about what I was talking about. His geography was so egregious. Where is Broadway at 50th Street compared with 8th Avenue? It's east of it, right? He had it west of 8th Avenue. Why? Because every angle in his cartographic world had to be either at 180 degrees or 90. He couldn't have a line angling up at a 45-degree angle, which would have more accurately reflected the numbers 1, 2, and 3 between 50th Street Broadway and 72nd Street Broadway.
So to you, a subway map can't just be purely topological nodes and edges, like the London Underground map, which is very much distorts geography. It's got to match what's above ground.
Right. There was a former MTA chairman who headed London Transport for a couple of years. He looked at the London Underground map and he said, well, you know, I want to go to this station. It was miles away from where he wanted to go. Imagine a subway rider standing at 8th Avenue and 50th Street, saying, well, I want to take the number one, and walking west on 50th Street to find Broadway. It'd fall into the Hudson River before he'd find it. I mean, it's one thing to have a quasi-geographic map where things are perhaps expanded because of the concentration of service or contracted because there's not much going on. Vignelli just didn't give a fig about stuff like that. It was all aesthetics. Vignelli was of the Bauhaus school, which advocated that less was more. I always feel that I'm more a Beaux-Arts person, which people would describe as saying more is not enough. The audience was 50-50, probably. Nobody took a vote saying, okay, all of you people in the audience who like the Vignelli approach, raise your hand. So we really don't know what the response was. But somehow, good prevailed. Or better prevailed. But we were still stuck with the problem with the Transit Authority. They would not budge on color coding. And in late August, I was walking down a hallway at the MTA, and the woman coming towards me was Phyllis Cerf Wagner. She was then married to the former mayor, Robert Wagner. She was the head of the aesthetics committee at the MTA, a dollar a year job. She said, how's progress on the map? And I told her that we were dead in the water. I explained the problem. She said, well, you know, let me see some samples of what you're talking about. We had never made any samples. So a fellow who worked for Hertz, Nobu Sarasi, made about a half a dozen roughs. I told Nobu that I didn't care what color was ascribed to which trunk line, but we just needed variations on a theme. We showed them to Mrs. Wagner. She called the chairman. The chairman said, it makes sense to me. I agree with you, Phyllis. This makes perfectly good sense. So he called John DeRoos, who was the president of the Transit Authority. That afternoon, it was a done deal. It had only taken me 4 bloody years to get this through. And then came, you know, what color to apply to which line. And there was a guy working at the Transit Authority in the Public Affairs Department, Len Ingalls. He thought that the TA should try to salvage as many colors as possible. So he thought, well, you know, the number 2 line on the West Side IRT, probably the most used. So why don't we make the West Side IRT red? And after it had all been determined, I realized that there was a certain socioeconomic joke that could be made about all this. The West Side IRT was red, and the West Side was where all the comm simps lived, right? The green line went up the Upper East Side, where all the money is.
This 4-year logjam came to an end because you ran into Wagner in the hallway, and Wagner had enough juice with the chairman.
Yes, I mean, you know, she's the wife of the former mayor. You know, they were all dealing on the same level with each other. And Mrs. Wagner did some financial fishing, you might say, and she found some money, I forget where. I never did understand where it came from. That would go to subsidize changing all the signage in the subway. That's what made a huge difference.
Nobody would have to rob their budget for this color overhaul.
Right. I mean, it made no difference in the printing of the map, but it was all the signage that had to be changed.
Who is the sharp end of the design at this point?
Nobu Sarasi. Nobu was a true artist and a true sculptor. He started working for Mike about spring of 1978. If you look at the rough, the test map that came out in the spring of 78, and compare that map with the finished map that Nobu oversaw, the difference is remarkable. There are so many subtleties to what Nobu did that had not been done before. So I always say that the aesthetics of that map are due entirely to Nobu. And it was Nobu who was working the mechanical 2 passes on a 6-color press, 11 overlays. So every time the slightest thing was changed, it would affect God knows how many other layers. I mean, using mechanicals compared with using Adobe Illustrator today is a difference of 180 degrees.
So you have no nostalgia for the old days of getting out your scalpel?
In order to do the job properly requires the skill of a Nobu. He really is what made the map look great. The map was published in the end of June 1979. The New York Times ran an editorial saying the best subway map in years. Paul Goldberger wrote a story with a headline, At Last, a Usable Subway Map. Yeah, the map was given a commendation for design excellence by the United States Department of Transportation and the National Endowment for the Arts. That ain't half bad, right? And it's still the bones of today's map. There are huge differences, though, between today's map and the 1979 map. No improvements have been made.
Not even the Staten Island inset?
I don't want to get too graphic in what I say, but who the fuck needs Staten Island on a subway map?
A true Manhattan guy.
Let's get serious. What the MTA has done is print all of those maps, Long Island Railroad, Metro North, Sertoa, on one big, a large piece of paper. So when somebody wants to know the routes on Sertoa, he is given an enormous piece of paper, which is financially wasteful to the MTA. Also, All he gets is a map, no information on the operation of Staten Island Rapid Transit Operating Authority, and the same for the Long Island Railroad and Metro North, etc. If somebody wants a map of Metro North, he doesn't give a fig about the Long Island Railroad. He's concerned with Metro North. He wants to know schedules. He wants to know what the difference is between weekday and weekend service and late night service, etc. You're not told any of that stuff on today's map. And in the top right-hand corner of the 1979 map were two sets of things. One was an inset that says how to use this map. And it depicted all the different symbols on the map, transfers and special rush hour service, etc. And then there were columns. The first column would be the route, the name of the route with a number or letter, then operates between. The number one would operate between 242nd Street, Van Cortlandt, Bronx, and South Ferry, Manhattan. Times, all times. Manhattan, local. Bronx, local. Brooklyn, a blank, because it didn't operate in Brooklyn. Every line was covered. Do you find that on today's map? No. You don't even find weekend service on today's map. It's only weekdays service. No mention about weekend service except reading some palaver that gives you bad directions. No late night service. The New York City Transit Authority is just about the only rapid transit service that operates 24/7. Washington shuts down, Paris shuts down, London shuts down, not the subway, 24 hours a day. And you'd think that the TA would be proud of that and have a map that shows late night service. Do they? No. Other changes that they've never made, the street or avenue of operation. In the 1979 map, we had the street or avenue of operation operating alongside the route. When the new Second Avenue subway opened, they published a map heralding the fact that the Second Avenue subway was open, but did they have the name of the street of the avenue of operation operating alongside it? No. I got the map that was published in last August, and they actually have Second Avenue now, the word, alongside the route. What they have never done, however, is simplify the coordinates, the street of operation and the station name. Say you're at 72nd Street on Broadway, waiting for the 1, 2, or 3. What's important about that intersection is that Broadway is intersecting Amsterdam Avenue. So if you're standing on 74th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, you do not have to walk west a half a block to Broadway and then turn south. You can just walk down Amsterdam Avenue to the intersection of 72nd Street. On my map these days, I say 72nd Street, Broadway at Amsterdam Avenue. And I have all of the streets of operation as an integral part of the station name. So you don't have to see the name of the station and then go search for the street of operation. Also, when you get up north of 168th Street on the 1, it just says St. Nicholas Avenue on the MTA map. Well, there are about three different streets of operation north of 168th. Because, you know, the line starts angling east. No indication that, you know, if somebody is at, if somebody is at Dyckman Street, he's not going to find the train operating on St. Nicholas Avenue there, or 207th Street. It's on 10th Avenue, for Pete's sake. Also, the service. They still have the name of the station and the service under it. And if it's a local station, there's a hash mark. If there's a express station, there's a circle. On my map, I have the service right on the line itself in a right-angled image. If a local station, in a circle or an oval, if an express, and joined if there's a transfer between express and local. So everything is a much faster read as a result, much more didactic.
At 79, this all comes out. Does your involvement with the formation of this map continue through the next editions?
I was declared redundant in about 1987. started looking for a job, and my wife said, you don't want to go back and work for a large organization. You hate status report meetings. You think they're a waste of time. Why don't you do it on your own? You don't need to be employed in order to design your own maps, and you don't have to be employed in order to write. You know, by 1978, I had written not just the travel guide for the MTA, but in 1979, a book was published by Holt Reinhart called Essential New York. A few years after that, Elegant New York was published by Abbeville. And in 1995, Scribner published The Empire State Building, The Making of a Landmark. And in 1999, was the first edition of New York from the Air with the great aerial photographer Jan Artus Bertrand. And there are three editions of that book. And then a couple of years ago, Manhattan's Little Secrets was published. So I've kept at it, and I haven't had to go to a single status report meeting. I do have to pledge my allegiance to the president of Taranac Limited, who is my wife, because she is now a retired lawyer. She would do all the business and all the legal contracts and all that business. And I'm still designing maps. Well, I mean, I haven't designed a new map since 2020. My most recent subway map was published in the height of the COVID crisis. People will think I'm nuts to publish a subway map in the midst of the COVID crisis, but my belief was that people would be returning, and sure enough, people are. You know, the problem with the printed map these days, the exploited, deleted Googles of the world, people don't want to bother with a printed map anymore. They just want to go to their handy-dandy iPhone or something.
Whenever I've relied purely on a map of the New York City subway to get me from place to place, I'm punished by service changes. I have to start digital just to make sure I can get from A to B.
You're one of the cursed ones.
Better use the computer than be stranded. I've had too many cold nights on cold platforms. When you published New York from the Air, did you commission all those aerial photos?
No, I don't publish it. It's published by Harry Abrams. I'll go up in the helicopter sometimes with Jan. And the first time I went up with him, I just assumed that he would roll down a window. No, the helicopters he rents have two rows. Pilot and yours truly sit in the front row. And he and an assistant sit in the back row. And Jan removes the side of the helicopter where he is sitting. And he will step out on a running board, hang out of the helicopter with his camera, which is, he uses telephoto lenses that are probably 2 feet long. He's as strong as an ox. He's a former longshoreman. And he'll pat me on the shoulder and he'll say, John, what is that down there? And he'll see some infinitesimal thing and ask me to identify it. He has eyes like an eagle. And he just shoots away. And I don't know if you've ever seen his photographs, but he is absolutely remarkable. I mean, his photographs are fantastic.
I'd love to ask you about the construction of Block by Block. Did you do all the illustration yourself?
Yes. I was introduced to Adobe Illustrator by a graphic designer who did the first couple of maps at Taranac Limited. And I was sitting there with him one day, and he was working away. I said, gee, you know, I wish I could do that. And he said, well, I bet you could. He said, here, take the mouse and press this button and see what happens. So he encouraged me to do it myself. And I got a Mac, and I got Adobe Illustrator, and started doing it. I did block by block on a Macintosh computer with Adobe Illustrator. I would get, I suppose, city planning commission maps and work from them in order to get the scale right. But there are times when I'd have to shift whole sets of blocks in order to accommodate a subway line or a bus line or something. And the color coding for the buses is not the same as on the MTA maps, which are predicated on trunk lines. I know because I was the guy in 1980 who said bus routes should be predicated on the same logic as subway routes, and we should have trunk line color coding. Well, the problem with frontline color coding on buses is that a bus that will go down Fifth Avenue, for instance, might go back up on Fourth and Madison. So you have two avenues being the avenue of operation for buses with the same color, which doesn't make much sense. So I realize that when people talk about buses in Manhattan, they're only talking about crosstown buses and up and downtown buses. So I thought we need a color for eastbound, a color for westbound, a color for southbound, and a color for northbound. And when I say we, I mean Tara and Act Limited. You know, I tried to figure out what colors would be appropriate. North-south was easy. If it goes north, it's blue because it's going towards the cold. If it's going southbound or downtown, it's red because it's going down to the warm south. If it's westbound, it's orange because it's going into the setting sun. And then I couldn't figure out what I needed for eastbound, and I determined that it should be green toward the Emerald Isle. That's the color coding for the buses, which is much simpler because it really fills the basic need of people. And, you know, when you get to 57th Street, for instance, you'll have both east and westbound crosstown buses and south and northbound up and downtown buses. So there are places on 57th Street that, and this is where I had to shift a whole set of blocks in order to accommodate all those routes. The first draft of block by block took 3 years, from 1997 to 2000, because I walked every block in Manhattan. Where I couldn't walk, such as highways, my wife would drive me on exits and entranceways, sometimes over and over again, just so that I got the exits and entrances right. And then I determined that we should have one-way streets indicated. Said to my wife, well, you know, that should be easy. You know, just call DOT, right, Department of Transportation. They'll be able to send me all the one-way streets and which way they go. No, DOT did not have a list of one-way streets, which was unbelievable to me. When I would walk a street, I would make sure that I was indicating that whether it was eastbound or westbound or uptown or downtown. And then just to make sure, my wife would drive me around sometimes and double check, because some streets are eastbound in one section and westbound in another.
You would walk every block. You'd carry a notebook with you to log all this stuff?
Yes, I had roughs of the street and I would fill in lines for important destinations. You know, every hotel, for instance, is listed, every museum, every hospital, theaters, you name it. You know, it's all basically all there. And they had to be accurately placed. You know, I would look at Land Map, Bromley or Sanborn, etc. They're absolutely geographically accurate. And they, you know, I would make sure that I've got my roughs in the right place. I had to make indices, and it was relentless, and I was doing all this myself.
Did you have an enormous master sheet? It's like a 4x3 foot poster board that you would keep track of your progress on?
No, I seldom think macroscopically. I think microscopically. And I'm a plotter. I'll have a general idea of what I want to do, and I'll start doing it. I mean, you know, it's like setting out to write about the undercover passageways. You know, I'll set out to do something and start working on it and realize it's lousy and scrap it. And that's the way I would go about mapping things, too.
You released Manhattan Block by Block in 2000. What was the response?
The New York Times said, Manhattan Block by Block, quote, offers just about all the critical information a sightseer might need. Sightseer spelled S-I-T-E, which I think is a great double entendre. So it offers just about all the critical information a sightseer might need, dash, and then some. Columbia Magazine called it a small marvel. So those are pretty good recommendations, right?
When you revised a few years later, did you have to rewalk the streets?
No, as we had the Times delivered to our front door every morning, and I would assiduously read the Metro section, and on Sundays the real estate section, etc., just to keep abreast of what was going on. And I was still I would give walking tours of the city, and I was teaching the New York Social and Architectural History at NYU School of Continuing Education. And, I would try to keep on top of things. And I always carried around a copy of Block by Block with me. And every time I noticed that something had changed, I'd just be passing by. Sometimes it was pure serendipity. I would make a notation that something is gone or something has changed or something's been added, who knows? And then make the revisions from those changes.
That's a remarkable document in itself, exhaustive tome with hand-drawn annotations.
Well, I had the final drafts of the first of the undercover maps, and I was talking with the map division of the New York Public Library about 6 months ago. I said, well, if you're interested in having the drafts for your collection, I'll happily send them to you. Well, I've been looking for them ever since.
Taranac Maps needs an archivist, too.
Yeah.
Your bread and butter is very long-term, longitudinal projects. If I gave you another 10 years to make a map, did you have a project in mind?
Do I have a project in mind? No. Years ago, my wife said, John, we should think about getting these things online. And I was told that the cost to metamorphose a printed map into something online and active is a gazillion dollars. So we just never did it. And people just aren't buying printed maps anymore. I get an order from Rand McNally every, 2 months for maybe 50 copies of the new subway map, but that's about it. I mean, I used to send out hundreds of maps a month, but no more. Yeah, I mean, you can walk into a store that used to sell maps and not find any anymore. I used to go to bookstores, or Hagstrom had its own map store on 43rd Street, just east of 6th. There was a map store on 53rd Street between, I think, Park and Lex. All gone. My wife and I were standing on 86 in Lexington a couple of weeks ago, and I looked around and I told Jane that if I had been deposited there and not told where I was, I would say, I don't recognize anything. I don't know where I am. RKO 86 is gone.
So Manhattan itself has just changed so much.
Yes, I mean all the oversized apartment houses on Millionaires Row, for instance. I don't have any of those on the most recent edition of Block by Block.
Do you have an edition of Block by Block that's one enormous sheet, something you'd stick on a wall?
Nope, I would have to shift a gazillion things because, I was talking about 57th Street as an example of being crowded. There are areas where I would shift, basically a half of a spread to accommodate something. So I wouldn't be able just to pick up everything and drop it into a huge poster-sized map, for instance.
It was designed at the page level, not designed big and then chopped up.
Precisely, precisely.
Well, I only brought that up because I interviewed a cartographer in Canada who thought, I'm going to make an exhaustive map of Alberta and an exhaustive map of Saskatchewan. And the maps turned out to be enormous, maybe 6 feet by 5 feet,
Good Lord.
but they were very brisk sellers because a lot of his customers were rural. They were accustomed to large scale things and living a large scale life because it's a big empty plane. He filled his car with these enormous rolls and would set up a table at government conferences and hunting and fishing shows, and he'd sold them. He has his own independent map business of enormous wall posters.
Well, you've inspired me. I'll tear apart a copy of Block by Block and see, start pasting it together.
As a final question, are there any cartographers or map makers living or dead that you recommend?
Is Delorme up in Massachusetts still in business? They were pretty good. Do you know the map distributor called MapLink? They're now out of business, but some of their business has been taken over by a company in the Midwest. I did the first edition of Block by Block in association with MapLink. They arranged for the printer, etc., who was up in Canada, and we split the costs. They were the biggest map distributor in the country at the time, and then they folded, 2010 maybe. Tout ça change tout le même bullshit, right?
And I really appreciate this, John. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Adam. We'll talk soon.
see John's work at johntauranac.com. JohnTauranac. For show notes and bonus content, visit veryexpensivemaps.com. This episode is brought to you by The Map Consultancy, supplier of professional, data-driven maps for your decks, reports, walls, and events. Visit themapconsultancy.com to see what good maps can do for you. I'm Evan Applegate, I'm a cartographer, and you should make your own maps.
No one wants to see dull, ugly maps. If you want to get through to your customers, you need the best cartography money can buy. The Map Consultancy will create maps with your data and your branding, PowerPoint decks, annual reports, conferences and events, your office walls. The Map Consultancy does it all. Visit themapconsultancy.com and get the best maps today.